Bonjour les fans des montres. Hello watch fans. This is David of the Real Time Show's resident provocateur back at you with another article. Now this one is actually a continuation of the last one we published on my thoughts about why the year 2024 might see a downturn for the watchmaking industry. Now this is significant because anyone that knows watches at all knows that the last few years have been a rocket ship trajectory for the business. This has been very beneficial for some, very frustrating for others, and I think in 2024, we may see the tides turning. Today, I don't want to talk predictions, though. I want to talk actual implications, and I'm going to do so with the indirect help of a living industry legend. As they say, history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme, and this particular person surely knows a thing or two about that. Is your interest piqued yet? Fantastic. Let's get right to it. In the Real Time Show's last article and its associated analysis discussion, Rob Allen and I talked about the very real possibility that the wind could materially leave the watch industry sales in 2024. As far as I see the situation, the secondary market balloon has been popped, and the contagion could reach upstream sellers before too long. The discussion and feedback we've already experienced have been enriching, but as far as I'm concerned, the topic of a coming downturn hasn't been fully explored until I attempt to answer the crucial question. So what? In my professional life, I've tried to train myself to remember that insights alone aren't worth nearly as much as those associated with implications and possible courses of action. With that in mind, in this article I'm going to outline, with some help from a watch industry legend, and I'll get to how I'm going to do that in a moment, what I think various watch industry stakeholders could do if they believe, like I do, that the lights have been turned on and it's time to leave the party that's been happening since 2020. I need to mention a few quick disclaimers before I start. Ideally, I'd have lots of up-to-the-minute data to refer to, but that's not the case for this article. So please consider everything I say from now on a hypothesis, or at the very most, an educated suggestion. The second point is that owing to that, none of this should be construed as any sort of official consultation. So if you try to implement any of these suggestions and they don't work out, as the youth today says, don't at me, please. To put some structure around this discussion, I'll break this down into buyers and sellers of watches, and then I'll cover the brands. Let's start with sellers, because one could confidently argue that they've been benefiting hand over fist the last several years. If, like me, you're not above a little sweet comeuppance, I think they will be hit the most immediately, and in fact, that impact seems to already be felt. I do actually have some data to cite here, with WatchCharts.com's overall price index dropping from about $32,400 in late July 2023 to about $29,900 in late January 2024, representing an 8% drop. It's important to note that brands that were heavily hyped, such as Rolex, Patek Philippe, and Audemars Piguet, are driving the magnitude of this decline, while other brands such as Omega and Breitling that did not quite ride the rocket ship upwards have not declined as much. Though, to be clear, the last 6 months have brought generalized secondary market price declines, at least according to watch charts. So what does this mean if you're a seller? Well, that depends on where you think the market is going. And since I believe the market has not yet bottomed out, I'd do what I could now to sell the watches I have and get cash in the door. If you were unlucky enough to buy up a lot of, for instance, Rolex stock not too long ago, you might be tempted to sit on your inventory to try and recoup as much of that investment as possible. My hypothesis is that this would be a mistake, and your situation will only get worse as more people start to find success with ADs directly, which will lead secondary market dealers to continue adjusting their pricing further downwards. If it were me in this situation, I'd rather sell now, even at a loss, and have cash to stay alive rather than sit on my hands and take an even greater hit down the line. This naturally leads me to anyone in the market for a luxury watch. If that's you, congratulations. After years of headaches, the pendulum is finally swinging in your favor, and if I'm right in my market assessment, it has a way still to swing. So deals could be in your future if you're willing to wait just a bit longer before making your purchase. If you've been eyeing a model that was previously unobtainium, my feeling is that, while you still may have to wait once you place an order, after all, no AD can stock vast quantities of expensive inventory, you shouldn't be looking at years on a vague waiting list. If you're looking at watches that were more conventionally obtainable the last several years, I believe that we will see backups forming in 80 stockrooms, so you should be able to get a deal with some discounting. However, with brands increasing prices, and this is something I'll revisit in a moment, your best bet for a bargain will be, here it is again, the secondary market, Here's where I feel things will get interesting. As people make room for other hobbies or need cash for other aspects in their lives, and as the ridiculous expectation that any luxury watch can be a, quote, investment fades away, I expect that some of the huge influx of watches that resulted from the pandemic will find its way back into the market. As that happens, it will become easier for you to scoop up a deal. If it gets to the point where brands start buying back inventory as they did in the mid-2010s, all bets are off, and you could be looking at getting a luxury watch at fire sale pricing if you're willing to mine gray market channels patiently. Now, to be clear, this is an extreme case, but one that I still feel is probable given the trends I see in the market currently. This is a good place to transition to the brands. Before I do that, a word on purchasing. The pandemic brought about all kinds of unsavory profiteering and otherwise bad behavior. This was unfortunately widespread, and the watch industry had its fair share. I'm sure you realize immediately what I'm talking about here. Salespeople who made no effort to make new customers feel welcome, knowing full well they would sell everything they had before it hit cases. Placements on years-long waitlists, which may or may not have existed in exchange for buying thousands of dollars of slower-moving products, and that's only two examples among many. Of course, you as a consumer are free to buy from wherever you'd like. But you know what? If you know of such stories, don't buy from these outlets, please. They crawled in the muck on the backs of potential customers to make as much as they could. So now, I trust they have plenty of cash to figure out how to ride out the tough times. Okay, that's me off my soapbox. Let's move on to brands. I think we can assume, in anticipation of a potential slowdown, that they are checking to make sure that all their debt facilities are in order, they have made any requests now to wealthy benefactors while things are going well, and that they have thought about how to rationalize their supplier costs before there is a mad rush to do so during a downturn. This is all important, but I'd rather focus on four aspects of preparing for, or indeed enduring, a downturn that are more directly relevant to the direct discussion of watches. And let's be honest, they're just less dry. So there are four of these, and they are: first, pricing; two, the product pipeline; three, marketing; and four, the watchmaking labor force. So now it's time to bring in that assistance I mentioned at the top of the article with the help of a living legend. Leave it to Jean-Claude Biver to know a thing or two about the watch industry and its cyclicality. As I consider these four topics, I can't help but think of an interview he gave to Revolution Magazine founder Waco around the time of the last downturn in the mid-2010s. I highly encourage everyone to watch this interview. If you go to YouTube and search for Jean-Claude Biver Revolution Part 1, it should be near the top of the search listings. Okay, so perhaps deliberately in a nod to the times, the interview started off directly with a question about pricing. In the good times going back to the 1980s, said Biver, no one cared about the cost of luxury watches. However, from the vantage point of 2016, he said that the technical challenges to making a complicated watch were a non-issue. Rather, quote, "The problem is how I can make it, a tourbillon, so that the perceived value is twice the price. People are looking now for value. Value, value, value," end quote. These words were valid in 2016, and I have a strong feeling that they will be just as applicable as we exit what some have called the free money era. You, of course, can't talk about pricing without referring to the products to which these values are associated. So let's talk about the product pipeline, a topic on which Jean-Claude Biver also had some wise words. In 2016, Jean-Claude Biver was leading Tag Heuer, and he outlined a three-point checklist for new watches where, if any one point was not satisfied, the watch would not be produced. The 3 points, which I'm attempting to generalize here for applications beyond Tag Heuer, were as follows. Number one, the product must be true to the brand's strengths and differentiating factors. Number two, the product must be targeted at an identified, clearly delineated segment of the market. And number three, perceived value must be at least double the price of the watch. This is such a simple checklist, but it encompasses basically everything there is to say about product market fit. And yet, you probably don't have to think too hard about a recent watch release that does not check each of these three boxes. If you've ever found yourself asking, okay, but who is this for, while reading a watch announcement, that's the kind of watch I'm talking about, and my feeling is that the days of companies being able to bank on such models are, for now at least, coming to an end. Any brand that believes the good times are coming to a halt should consider distilling down their own product checklist and really taking a hard look at what they have coming out in the next few years. I completely understand that sacrifices are tough and product conception in the watchmaking industry can take years. But everything that comes out in the future that does not hit the mark ultimately takes away resources from something else that does, or that could if more resources were devoted to it. In other words, if you have a 44mm chronograph planned for next year, looking at you here, Omega, my hypothesis is that there is very little chance that in today's market, with today's tastes, you have put yourself in a position to deliver a watch that provides double the value relative to price for a critical mass of customers. That last point is important. Of course, value is a relative, highly subjective term, and I think we can all agree that marketing goes a long way to forming a customer's perception of value. You would think that would make marketing a precious resource, but in fact, during a downturn, the marketing department is usually the first one put on the chopping block. Let's turn again to the thoughts that Jean-Claude Biver shared in his interview with Revolution. Quote, "We have a king and a queen, and that's all that we have to do is serve both. First, start with the king. Who is the king of Hublot? Stupid, immediate answer, the customer. If you want to serve a customer, you must know his history. Where does he come from? How is he educated? What does he like? What does he hate? What is his religion? What is his passion? What are his hobbies? All of this we have to know. The more we know, the better we can serve." End quote. Biver then goes on to say, quote, "The queen is the product. We must make the queen so beautiful, so sexy, so nice, so balanced, that when she meets the king, they fall in love." End quote. So any brand, no matter the size, must be able to answer succinctly. Who is my target customer? Are my watches designed with that customer in mind? And do my marketing efforts enable sufficient contact between the two to enable a match, and therefore, according to Jean-Claude Biver, sales? If those three questions are not satisfied, then a brand cannot say it is prepared for a downturn. In other words, a rising tide lifts all boats, but when the tide recedes, there are winners and losers. In a downturn, you can sell watches, but you cannot sell any new release. You have to be hyper-deliberate about your efforts. That means not treating marketing as a cost center when sales start to slow. The last thought I'll share on this for now is that staying the course has very tangible implications. For instance, if you have an ad strategy in place, you can go hard in your marketing efforts while everyone might be giving in to the temptation to pull back, thus potentially getting more bang for your ad bucks in the process. As important as marketing is to surviving a downturn, in watchmaking, the rubber meets the road at the bench. Believe it or not, Richemont actually carried out layoffs of its watchmakers in the mid-2010s. It's madness. I understand the very basic logic. Less people equals more profits. But talk about cutting off your nose to spite your face. In addition to taking morale, I wonder how much it costs to hire that workforce back and train it to manage the upturn the industry took a few years later. Today, there is a severe lack of watchmakers to the point where I wish I could turn back time and study this topic to earn the job security that should be available to me. I say should be because if I've realized one thing about business in my career, it's that you never get between a shareholder and their profits. So if and when things start to get rough, the watchmakers, most probably those employed by publicly traded brands or groups, could be on the chopping block again. I hope the industry does not repeat this course of action. If anything, the watchmaking department is a key lever in crucial areas such as cost reduction. And I encourage everyone here on this point to check out the interview where Jean-Claude Biver describes solutions that he and the watchmaking department had to various manufacturing problems. So, if the watchmaking department and its watchmakers are empowered and incentivized to find those creative solutions, magic can happen, with profits hopefully following later, of course. I'll end this on an even more hopeful note. Though I do believe that a downturn is coming and the watch industry will emerge differently than it entered, it will emerge. And when it does, I for one can't wait to see what the newly hardened and lean and mean brands have to show us. And that is it for today's article. As always, I want to thank you so much again for listening. And now it's your turn. What do you think? Was I on the mark? Was I way off the mark? I'd love to hear from you either way. And there are several ways for you to get in touch with us and the show to share your feedback. I can be reached on Instagram at DAVAUCHER. Rob can be reached at RobNudds. And Alan can be reached at AlonBenJosePh. We even have an Instagram handle for the show itself. That is at therealtime.show. If you prefer to use the old-fashioned World Wide Web, we love to hear from listeners via the contact form. The address for that is www.therealtime.show/contact. As always, I want to thank you again for taking the time to listen. I want to take the time to thank you in advance for sending us your feedback. And of course, I, Rob, and Alan very much look forward to having you tune into us on the next episodes of The Real Time Show. Thanks so much and take care.
Hi and hello, watch fans, and welcome to another edition of The Real Time Show with me, your friendly neighborhood watchmaker, Rob Nuts, our friendly neighborhood jeweler, Alan Ben-Joseph, and our resident provocateur, David Vaucher. We are back together once again to record an article analysis of the second part of David's article regarding the downturn of the watch industry. As you will notice, this is our first full article and article analysis show, as we mentioned, would be replacing the previous two-parters that we've been doing. So you should get one of these every 3 weeks or so, depending on the kind of content that we're able to produce for you. In the meantime, David, thank you for another excellently written article. It really sparked a lot of thoughts in our minds, and I'm looking forward to chopping it up with you today. Would you be kind enough to give our listeners a rundown of the article they've only just finished listening to?
Yeah, hey, Rob. Hey, Alan. And today, you know, I always look forward to talking watches with you too. Today's even more fun because, as regular listeners of this show will know, I personally love playing armchair CEO, and I think I've roped you two into the game now. And so today is going to be all three of us being armchair CEOs. So just to run down, you know, the chronology of how we got to here, the last article that I wrote, for which we've done an analysis already, was basically me laying out my thoughts as to why I think more than just a reversion to the mean from the last couple of crazy years, I think the watch industry, this is my hypothesis based on, you know, the data I'm seeing, just sort of looking at some various market dynamics, I think the watch industry may actually be due for a downturn. How severe that's going to be, I don't know, but I think it's going to be on the bad side of a downturn, if that makes sense, right? So, you know, my mindset whenever I'm putting forth a problem, because I suppose in this case that's a problem, is always to offer some solution. So in other words, you know, in my day job, I'll never say, this is how I think things are going to turn bad. I'll say, look, here's what I think is going to happen. Here's why I think it's going to happen. Here's maybe two or three scenarios as to which is more probable. And, you know, these are some solutions I think we can address that with. And so today is the solution piece. And in the article, the second article, the one we're discussing today, I basically referenced a very influential interview that I saw years ago. And this was during the last downturn in the mid-2010s. By Jean-Claude Biver, who I don't think needs any introduction for anyone listening to the show. It was given to Waco with Revolution, so I highly encourage everyone to go on YouTube and check it out. Just search Jean-Claude Biver Revolution Interview Part 1. And on the basis of that interview, in the article, and this is what we'll discuss today, I think I laid out basically two or three different points that were relayed by Jean-Claude Biver. The first one is that as watch companies enter into a recession, because this is where they were in 2016, they have to provide value double the price. They must understand what their product is, and they must understand the customer. And the image he uses is that one is the king, one is the queen, and you have to play matchmaker. And I think that as the industry has grown in a way that it never has, I think it's gotten away from those basic principles. And today, I think we can discuss how some companies may have strayed from those and may be able to get back on track even during a downturn and sell some watches. So that is my long introduction. What do you and Alan, what do you and Rob think?
Well done, buddy. Great article again. I always listen to your articles, so I have listened to it like our dear listeners did just now. I actually concur with everything. You took one of the best marketing examples, not only for the watch industry, but for all marketeers, because I actually refer often to that interview that you used between Jean-Claude Biver and Waco. And I love the metaphor of bride and groom, the king and queen, him setting the stage for them to meet each other and then get married. I have a question coming hot for you guys. Will we be able to buy Rolexes with a discount at the retailers, the ADs for Rolex in 2024?
Look, I'll go first on this one, but I'm going to keep it short. I have no idea. I can't envisage it for any of the popular models. You know, for all other models that have been on waiting lists, I'd say there's still not a chance in hell. I went into a retailer in London Heathrow the other day. The guy was a dick, by the way. So, you know, go somewhere else to buy your Rolexes. I went in there and I was like, oh, do you have any of the gold Daytonas to show? And he was like, this is for exhibition only. All I have for sale are these four models here. I said, I'm not interested in those four models. I've walked in with a specific product request. Do you have any? And he went, everything's for exhibition only. I said, yeah, fine, I get it. But do you have a gold Daytona that I can try? You know, I want it on the Oyster Flex. And he went, I have a bicolor one. No, he said, I have a roller saw model that's steel and gold, by the way. And I was like, yeah, okay, thanks. I've just said Oyster Flex. I'm pretty sure you can assume that I know what roller saw is, but besides the point, it's not what I asked for. It's fucking gross. And if I'd asked for it, even if I didn't want it, he probably would have never given me a discount in a million years. So I just say no. No way. Not a chance in hell. David?
Yeah, I'm the provocateur, so I'm going to say that yes, but not in 2024. I think 2025, we should get back to that state. And I don't know if we want to get right into Rolex, but I think, Rob, that is a great example because I think it gets to the heart of some of the issues I think some companies are going to be dealing with going forward.
Look, you just dodged the question entirely there. I mean, I was trying to answer the question. He said 2024, like, no, 2024, no, but like 2025, okay, I'm still going to say no. I'm kidding.
So let me go back on that then. I think that certain models, like you said, if the answer is just categorically, do I expect there to be discounts? Yes. Do I think those will be across the board? Let's wait till 2025.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. All right. So you reckon that maybe something like, I don't know, 40 millimeter day dates appeal to some people, don't they? So something like a, I don't know, 1908?
That's a good example. I think just a date just, honestly, just the regular, I mean, fine. Maybe if you're going for like the more interesting dials, and I use that kind of loosely, but I think just a date just, why should you pay at MSRP for that? I mean, every Rolex boutique should have them in stock. And traditionally they've been the volume seller. So I think something like a date just.
I haven't seen a date just. Like, okay, maybe you're saying like the ones off the beaten track. Yeah, fine. Okay, maybe they are occasionally in stock and available to purchase. But I've been in maybe 10 Rolex boutiques over the last 10 months, say, just different airport boutiques. Normally, I don't tend to go around the towns looking for them. But when I'm killing some time, I love to go in and see what they've got. And they've had absolutely nothing desirable. So
it sounds like we're talking Rolex. So let's talk Rolex.
let's talk Rolex.
Okay. So I really want to couch this in what Jean-Claude Bigard said. You know, value double the price, and you got to match the king and queen, the customer, or the product. Rolex particularly, but not other brands, or not the only brand, rather, there's others, but Rolex particularly has had this, that their popularity driven by the fact that the value people were getting, and they were willing to pay well over MSRP, wasn't directly tied to just the watch itself. It was because there were, you know, the money could only go certain places. They couldn't get out. You know, there was all this money, you know, hitting people's pockets for various reasons. And as that happened, dealers, I think, got comfortable in a way that you just described, Rob. And I think that the king is the customer, changed. So I'll just tell you this personally, Rob, like, I don't think I would wear a Rolex for a long time because I don't associate myself with a lot of the people that are wearing Rolex now. And I think you can make the case that the marketing that Rolex has done so well on for 50 years doesn't really correspond to that audience anymore. So as you have people over the last couple of years who've been mistreated by Rolex, burned by Rolex, who have taken the time to find other things that provide them value, I just cannot see how you're at a point where you're still selling Rolex days just to where they don't make it to the cases, right? And so if I just think through that mental exercise, yeah, the discounts have to come sooner or later. What do you think?
Well, I think you made a very good point in there, but I'd like to qualify it a little further. And that is building on what Jean-Claude said, double the value of the price, right? So that would theoretically mean that a Rolex Submariner, let's call it 10K, should be a 20K watch that you can buy for 10K. Now, the irony with Rolex is the product is not a 20K product. It's not a 10K product, really. But throughout the pandemic, the further surrounding Rolex was such that the watches were selling for 20K. So that's a weird sort of twist on his mantra that the watches, although materially aren't 20 grand products, they were perceived as 20 grand products. And so the retail price seemed like a bargain. But what I would like to say about your assessment of the Rolex customer changing, I think you're saying sort of specifically through a pandemic because they had all this extra cash. I think that that's definitely the reason why watchmaking in general experienced the boom. And I suppose it enhanced and exaggerated every brand's trajectory. I don't think that we can really put Rolex's current position, what it's evolved into, this phenomenon that separates it from other watch companies, the way it behaves in the market, the way its customers behave. I don't think we can put that down to the pandemic. I think that was happening before everything shut down. I think that if you go back 10 years, or maybe a little further now, you know, when you had Hulks gathering dust in windows and selling for way below MSRP, that was a different era. But the Rolex brand had changed into the unstoppable behemoth of status and had bled out into mainstream consciousness far before the pandemic started. And then the pandemic, yeah, of course, exacerbated everything with every brand. But Rolex was, I think, probably because of the volume of the interest in the brand, benefiting from it greatly. And yeah, are there more Rolex customers than there ever have been? Of course there are, because there's more Rolex watches being made than there ever have been. And there's fewer available to buy in retail stores than ever before, as far as we can tell, if we assume that all of that is legitimate and not just a screen thrown up by Rolex to push this idea that you just can't buy a Rolex if you want to. So I think there's a lot of things at play when it comes to Rolex. Would I buy one now at retail? Maybe I would because I want one, but not necessarily because I think that the product ascribes to Bivair's Maxim. I think maybe because that's the price and it's not a crazy, crazy price for a Rolex these days.
Okay, so I think we made a good point where Bivair's Maxim may not apply. So let's assume that Rolex is the special case, right? Because I think you could make an argument that they are apart from the rest of the watch world. Do you, Robin Allon, think that as the watch industry has grown, brands have stuck to that Maxim? And do you think that is there an effort to maybe on their part to get back to this, like providing much more value than the price of the watches?
Okay, up until this point, I'd say no. I'd say that throughout the pandemic, the watch industry en masse started feeling itself a little bit. I believe that's what the kids say, you know. It was believing it could get away with anything and being proven right at every turn. It was like a bad partner in a relationship. You know, if somebody cheats on you and you're not okay with that, but they're not punished with the end of a relationship, or I don't know what else you could say in that regard, but let's say you just say, okay, that was pretty bad, but you know, nothing's going to change, things are going to carry on, then they don't have much incentive to change their behavior. They'll probably do it again, and then you'll be left in a position where you're sort of chasing your own moral standards or your ethical standards or whatever it is to try and get back up to a point of parity, which, to be honest, if the original contract between two parties, let's say the king and the queen, again, maybe relevant, is violated in a way that insults one party to a point at which the foundation of their relationship is forever fractured, I don't think there's much point in fighting for that relationship. I know there's a lot of pop songs that say that we should always fight for this love. I don't agree with that at all. I think that everything is temporary and people move and develop and change, and something that worked at one point may not work in the future. And what we're seeing with the pandemic and the relationship that the brands abused between themselves and the customers was a thing of that time. Now, I'd say we're ripe for a breakup. We're going to reset the clock. We're going to go look for somebody that treats us a little bit more respectfully. We're going to go out there on Tinder and we're not going to just swipe right on every single profile. We're going to be a bit selective. We're going to say, okay, in the brand Tinder world, we should do this, by the way, that'd be hilarious. We should set up our own app called Watch Tinder. It probably exists already, but how about we look for brands that have identified quicker than others that there was a serious problem with the way that the industry was behaving during that period, where you're throwing out a really thoughtless special edition or a limited edition, really, which is a big problem, and driving people into a frenzy with this incredibly overwhelming marketing campaign that they couldn't possibly avoid, getting themselves into a way of thinking, God, I have to buy that watch now because tomorrow it's going to be worth twice as much. And if I don't buy it, oh, I'm going to regret it for the rest of my life. And it's value, it's value, it's value. They forgot the link between the product and the price. And it's going to be difficult for brands to readjust, you know, to go to therapy and to sort of look in the mirror and say, oh, I behave badly. How do I win back the trust of my customers? Because I think you're absolutely right in what you specify in the article. Brands have to now really be very customer focused. They have to eat a big slice of humble pie and say, we've seen a downturn, not like any other, but under different conditions than we've ever seen before. So we need to now reassess. We need to build back up. It's very difficult for some brands. I'll use one example before I let you jump back in, and that's the IWC Ingenieur. And I've referenced it many times because I think it's an absolutely superb watch. I think it's a beautiful renaissance of a much missed model line. And it's come back with aplomb. And yet the price point is a symptom of the environment, the pandemic environment that we've now exited. And it hit the market a bit late for IWC, I think. And I think that they're going to struggle because I do not agree with the reduction of prices of existing model lines. I think that's really bad from a branding perspective. I think it's bad for customer relations, for people that paid the full retail price. If IWC turned around next week and said, okay, the Ingenieur is now 7K, which I think would make it an incredible proposition and something I would like to buy, I think that would be a bad move on their part. And it's a shame that they've spunked a beautiful model line in such a climate, because for me, the only way to reassess these things or to go back and rebalance the books is to release new model lines that have the same value proposition as the product would have done had it been positioned at a lower price point and start again.
Yeah, or just, you know, put more features in without changing the price. Yes, Alan, you know, I want to ask you, because you're like on the front lines in the retail business. You know, to me, it seems like you're the one that has to do the heavy lifting at the end of the day. Like whether, you know, or especially in a downturn, you are now the one that has to convince the customer like, hey, this watch costs X, but you're going to get 2X out of it if you buy it. So, I mean, what has your approach been to making that match between king and queen during a downturn relative to something like something kind of like what we've seen the last couple of years where it's just crazy for everyone?
So I always see that glass half full. The beauty of being that venue where the groom and bride meet, the king and queen, because that's the most important function of being a retailer, is facilitating them for them to meet and to fall in love, to literally quote Mr. Beaver. So seeing it from a positive side, the reduction of the waiting times is a reduction of annoyance, of irritation. A lot of sales literally got canceled because of the fact that they had to wait so long. So that's the upside. Now, it's a bit dangerous that we talk so hardcore about value, 2X, etc., because it's very subjective what a particular worth is for a buyer, right? Now, the whole discussion about stacking specs and keeping the price the same is a difficult one, because it seems that brands have a license to do price increases annually that is always higher than the inflation index. So it's a bit, it's murky waters, because you don't really know, is it the inflation of the Swiss franc, which they often use as an excuse, forex fluctuation, so foreign exchange rates. They say everything becomes more expensive, labor, materials. But let's be realistic, often it's just because they can get away with it, as Rob said. So the challenge now is, often these hot pieces, these hype pieces, were wanted because there were waiting lists. And then what do you do, right? In our TRTS network, there was a vivid discussion about, hey, I spotted streamliners in the window. Weren't those wanted? And that suddenly became a discussion, right? So as a retailer, there's suddenly, if you see the cup half empty, there is this stigma there that, oh, it's in the window. Oh, so it's not a good model. And that's a discussion I want to avoid. We always say on the pod, all three of us, we do not like it that watches are seen as a commodity, an asset class, an investment piece. So in that case, I don't like that discussion. Oh, so it's widely available. So it's not good. So those are my two cents on that topic. Does that answer your question, Dave?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, one thing, I don't, Rob, you know, you're going to jump in a second, but I think, Alan, you made a really good point, which is, even though I tend to be very analytical most of the time, value is going to be different for everyone. I think what he was saying at the time, because at that time, brands were just raising prices indiscriminately. And I think what it comes down to is that it's not enough for the watch not to be available to justify price. I think people are tired of that. So for whatever someone's internal calculator says or evaluator of value, gosh, that's a twisted way of saying it, but whatever everyone's scorecard is, it really needs to exceed what the price is. And I think that means brands are going to have to work a little bit harder. Rob, what do you think?
I absolutely agree. They need to work a little bit harder. Yeah, for sure. There was one thing that you said, Alan, that just flagged for me that I wanted to address, and that was the subjective interpretation of value. And of course, you are right. There's always a level of subjectivity in what something is worth to someone. But I think what we're saying, or what Bever is trying to communicate with his maxim, is that there are certain objective material qualities that you can point to. And it doesn't have to be an exact science. It doesn't have to be exactly twice of what that watch should cost. It's about market conditions, but it is also very much about the product itself. You know, if you have a watch that's solid gold, it has a higher material worth than a steel watch, even if the steel watch is more desirable. So you could say, like, a steel Lange nowadays, they don't exist on the market, but if they did, it would be more sought after than a yellow gold or a white gold watch. So that's taking his maxim and kind of adding some context to it, and maybe where it falls down more than anything. Because if I say to you, oh, Rolex Submariner is not really a 10,000 euro or dollar watch, you could say, well, it is, obviously, because people buy them hand over fist at that price. And you'd be right from a commercial perspective. Yeah, it sells, but it isn't adhering to the point. Something like a Fortis Novanaut, the most recent watch I bought, is a better value product in terms of what you get for the money. It's less than half the price, or it's, well, actually almost exactly half the price. It's about 4,500 euros, but it has pretty much identical specs. Now, you could say, oh, the movement is slightly better in a Rolex, but not by much. It's a Lejeune column wheel chronograph, and we're talking about an automatic time only or time and date from Rolex. Like, what's the difference, really? Not a huge amount. So I think that that is something that we should always be mindful of. We can't just say, oh, because status or rarity is desirable, it actually adds to the value of the product in an underlying sense. Do you know what do you know where I'm coming from with that?
Yeah. Although I guess I don't want to sidetrack the show too much, because there is a common belief that luxury means exclusivity, and I don't believe that. I mean, I think it's one thing for luxury the way it was, say, 100 years ago. Like, Louis Vuitton, for example, was a skilled craftsman. And if something was scarce at the time, it's because there just wasn't enough of that skilled craft's ability to make trunks and bags. So that's one reason. But something being luxurious just because it's not available, I don't understand that. And so, and this could just be me, because luxury is so much marketing. But I think there really has got to be something, like you said, Rob, it's got to be more tangibly linked to the product, or at the very least, I think brands really have to start identifying, okay, who are we serving, or who do we want to serve? does the pipeline of our models serve that particular customer base? And if not, how do we adjust? Because it really is existential at this point, right? I mean, if you don't adjust, you're not selling watches, and then ultimately you don't survive, which is no good for all of us, because I think we just want to see the business do well generally.
I absolutely agree that brands need to do that. When it comes to the definition of luxury or the application of the term luxury to all watches, I think that people are getting hung up on it in a weird way these days. I would say that luxury should really be reliant on exclusivity, because I think it's a sliding scale. You know, all watches are luxuries in a sense, because we don't need them to survive, certainly not with timekeeping devices all around us these days. There's one on my laptop, there's one on my phone, you know, there's one on my microphone transmitter over there. You know, I can see the time everywhere. So a watch is a luxury in that it's an unnecessary addition or embellishment to your life. But I think the idea of a luxury industry has kind of been polluted by the volume of products that fall within that broader sense of what is a luxury rather than what is a true luxury. And I think that it would help if there was a bit of a definition between that. Like, it's an overused word, basically. I don't think it has the meaning that it used to. Like, where do we stop saying a mechanical timepiece is a luxury item? Or do we never stop? And that's the question. If we never stop, then the word ceases to have any meaning. It's just a category. And if we do stop, at what point do we stop? Is it when we get to something that is mass produced? Is it only luxurious when it is an artisanal product, like Louis Vuitton's original output? Is it something that is deliberately scarce? And maybe there are tiers of luxury for people with different income brackets. Obviously, that is true on a personal level, but is it true on a macro level as well? I would rather say, let's just dispense with the term luxury watches for the moment and say quality watches, because when it comes down to the product, you know, all of these products are either luxury or most of them probably aren't. But are they quality? Are they good quality? And that is what I think brands need to focus on. I think, and again, you know, I am biased by my own personal perceptions. I am a product first guy. I believe in the power of branding and marketing to get the first sales. I believe wholeheartedly in the product to get the second, third, fourth, fifth, and subsequent sales. I believe that the product is the brand's best ambassador. The product is what a brand should live and die on. You can have brands that have terrible communication and excellent products, and they may sink because they don't have that effective connection with their audience. But when they get watches on wrists, then they start to grow. And I think that's really what we want from brands. We want them to focus on that first.
Boom, 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 boom. Rob has his philosophical hat on. This is not rare, but he's often not that fast and speedy. Rob, amazing. Let's do a case study now. What watch or brand doesn't give you value for money? Which one does? And how much value for money does, let's say, an Arkanaut give you?
Okay. Well, we can start with Arkanaut because you mentioned it specifically. Arkanaut gives you a lot of value for money in the traditional sense of luxury, in that it's scarce by its own nature. It's, what do we say, limited by nature, not limited deliberately, limited because we can't produce that many pieces because all the dials are certainly developed by hand to begin with, and then the processes, we try and refine them to make them more efficient, of course, because if every single dial cost us the same amount as the first dials cost us to discover, it wouldn't be a viable business. So ironically, it's a more luxurious product in that regard than a Rolex. Now, does it have as good a movement in it as a Rolex? No, it doesn't. It has a Soprod A10. It's comparable to a Rolex automatic because we're really nitpicking when it comes to accuracy and performance and shock resistance and temperature resistance these days. That's our nature. That's what we do. We're hobbyists, and it's our responsibility to be particular about those things. But in terms of a product that cannot be produced in high volume, Arkanaut is actually a really good example of an affordable sub 5,000 brand that does offer better value for money. Now, if you want to talk about a more mainstream brand, let's look at something like Christopher Ward, maybe. We know, because of Christopher Ward's transparent communication, that they charge three times what the watch costs them to make. And that is below what most brands would charge in terms of margins. Most brands would work with at least a four, probably a five times markup. That isn't the case for Arkanaut. Our watches have a smaller markup even than Christopher Ward, but they vary so much from piece to piece and research and development costs of each specific model that it's not something we can actually communicate in the same way as Christopher Ward, because it isn't a hard and fast calculation. So Christopher Ward maybe offers you better value for money than something like a Rolex, because let's face it, with the economy of scales they've got working for them, with almost a million watches produced per year, or I think by some sources they say even more than a million watches a year, that is an incredible advantage to creating an excellent product at a low cost to the brand. Now, let's be fair, Rolex spends so much money on promoting the brand of Rolex and the lifestyle surrounding it. That also has to be factored into the build cost. It's never just about the product when it comes to a brand. This is why I take issue with so many people on forums saying, oh, why does this watch cost 5,000 euros? The movement costs $250. The case probably costs about the same. The strap costs 20 bucks. The dial will cost like 100 maybe, the hands maybe 15 or 20 quid to make. Oh, the cost of this watch should be £700. And you think, yeah, but somebody made that and we didn't just make one. And there was design involved and there's salaries to be paid and there's marketing to pursue. There's events to attend. Like all of this is built into the product cost. Those aren't things that just happen by accident. So, big brands that give you good value for money and big brands that don't. I mean, I would have said in the past, only 2 or 3 years ago, that Omega used to make an excellent product of a comparable, although not quite as good, material standard as Rolex for almost half the price. Like the Seamaster 300M, for how many years, Alon, did I used to say, this is the best value luxury dive watch on the market? And in comparison to the Submariner, which streaked away from it in terms of price and, you know, started to get close to 10 before the Omega even got over 5. It was, in my mind, obvious what's the better product choice. You know, Omega's a globally recognized brand, extreme heavy-hitting name in the watch industry. And the watch itself was top, top draw, especially when they brought in their own in-house movements and they upgraded the bezel and the dial to the ceramic and they improved the luminosity on the dial and they had these new form-fitting rubber straps actually tapered when the old Seamaster, in fact, the current Seamaster bracelet still doesn't taper. Omega, for God's sake, taper that bracelet. You did a wonderful job with the Speedmaster. Do the same damn thing with the Seamaster and you will sell a bunch of them. Although you might not sell as many as you would have done if you hadn't raised the price to around 6K now. And that's for the regular ones, you know, 5,300, I think, for a white dial, black bezel on a black rubber strap, and then 5,700 for it on a bracelet, if memory serves. And I'm talking euros, by the way, for our international listeners. And then you've got the new one, like the 75th anniversary. It's like 6,700 or something stupid. Like, it's just way out on its own. And they don't even talk to you about the James Bond No Time to Die one. Gorgeous watch, beautiful. Personally, not a fan of the bracelet too much, but I think the watch head itself is absolutely stunning. Or the Necton, which is maybe my favorite. And if it had an open case back, I would have bought one already. But these watches are now creeping up to a point where not even I, a former advocate for the Seamaster 300M, can say, oh yeah, that's a good value watch. Speedmaster, hate to say it, same thing's happening. You used to be able to buy a Speedmaster even 5 years ago. You could probably get one for about 4K. You know, now they're, well, what's the new one? The new one's 8,100?
I think so. I didn't check the prices. And in our community, Omega took a big bashing on these extreme price increases.
Rob, you nicely actually summarized the last couple of articles because, you know, we've talked Omega before. We've talked price increases. And I think that that's really the message. So personally, Alon, I don't know if you're asking me the question as well, but I still think Omega is the best value in watchmaking. Now, I don't know what they've done recently. Not everything they make is for me, but if you find the model for you, like, there's just so much there to love. But I also wouldn't pay for it out of the case at the boutique. I just wouldn't, because you can go used because there is ample supply out there. And at that gray market or secondhand price, the value that you're getting is there. So I think that just encapsulates perfectly the issue that the watch industry has is that they're a victim of their own success, because it's one of the few industries that I'm going to say a slightly naughty word here, but I don't know if anyone's familiar with the term, the enshittification of everything, where basically price goes up and quality goes down.
I've never heard that before, but I absolutely love it.
So it is, I mean, I'm sure it happens in Europe, but in America, it's stuff like, you know, your bag of chips gets smaller, price goes up, or, you know, just like the quality of the service you have at a restaurant goes down, price goes up. It's the enshittification of everything. And the watch industry, to its credit, has not done that. Like, whatever they're doing behind the scenes to cut costs, it doesn't appear to me like it really comes off in the final product. And they're a victim of that, because if I buy a Seamaster 300M today, it's going to look just as good and work just as well in 2, 3, 4, 5 years' time. So Omega, to sell another one, has to find another customer willing to pay 10, 15, 20% more for the exact same watch. And I'm not sure how you do that unless you really identify, okay, who is my customer? What am I selling to them, rather than just kind of shotgunning models back and forth?
Yeah, it has to happen. But my interest, and I tried to explore that in some of the things I said already, but I know I haven't really got a very neat or comprehensive handle on the conversation yet. And that is, how do you do that? Like, what are the mechanisms to make the change from a brand that has been chucking out products and chucking up prices to someone that's able to then listen to the customer and make an effective change? How do they do that?
Can I be slightly boring and turn this into I'm getting really pretentious here. Can I turn this into a business school lecture, Rob and Alan? Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Of course. Just make sure you bring your soapbox.
Okay. It's extra tall. I think it's just, you have to be methodical about it, right? We've talked before about Omega, the Swatch Group, and Alan actually is the one that said it. I remember he said, look, the Swatch Group's job is to maximize ROI. So for shareholders, right? I'm sure stakeholders have, you know, their own wants and desires as well, but for shareholders to maximize ROI, that is a very like scientific metric. And so if you start from that point, then your process must also be scientific. So if I'm in a boardroom of any brand, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at my past results. I'm going to look at my recent results and say, are they on trend? I'll then look forward and say, okay, is this going the way I want it to? If it's not, then you have to do, I think it's like my favorite piece of advice ever. It comes from a book called The 7 Habits of Highly Successful People. I've never read it, but I know this habit and it's very useful. And it's start with the end in mind. So I'm going to say, right, here's where I want to be. Here's where I think I can get there. So, you know, let's say I want to grow revenue 20%. So I say, okay, what's my customer base now? Does that currently allow me to get to that 20%? And if not, you just keep working backwards. You say, I'm targeting this group of people in these places with these models. Oh, wait, these models are not adapted to this particular customer base's wants and desires. So I'm going to adjust and I'm going to keep iterating in that way, keep monitoring what's going on, until I get to my goal, and then obviously eventually surpass that. And again, not to be too repetitive, but that was the main point of the article, was that I think brands have gotten away with not doing that because they haven't had to. They're just like, we release a watch. It's like the internet meme, release a watch, make profit. And I think now there's really got to be a very like deliberate and detailed way of getting towards whatever their long-term goals are.
I appreciate the insight from a business school perspective, and obviously it has its place in watchmaking. Of course, we know watchmaking is a bit of a weird industry, and it doesn't necessarily behave as we'd like it to or follow the path that you'd expect it to if you laid it out for it. I was listening to our good friends podcast, Lydia Winters and Vubiri, on This Watch Life. This week, I've been catching up on some of the episodes that I missed while I was on the road, and they were talking a while ago now, I guess, because they have 5 episodes a week. In case you haven't checked out This Watch Life, it's a daily podcast from Monday to Friday. It's only about 20 minutes long per episode, so nice bite-sized dose of daily watch content. They were discussing the Swiss watch export numbers this year, and it's around, I think, 16 million units. 16.9 million watches, okay? Quite good. It's more than last year. Great. It represents a value, an export value of 26.7 billion Swiss francs. Now, although that's an increase of 7.6% on 2022, when you look at these figures compared to one another over the last 23 years, let's say, I'll go right back to the start of the century, the trend is extremely obvious. In the year 2000, there were almost twice as many watches being sold, but the value was about 65% of what it is this year. So let's say, just I'm rounding up here very bluntly, but around 30 million units sold in the year 2000 for a total value of 10.3 billion. Okay, now over the ensuing years, the numbers have not consistently but steadily dropped in terms of units until 2021, where they jumped up again for the first time in almost 10 years. And then 2022 was almost the same. 2023 saw a small increase. But the values are increasing exponentially, effectively, per product. So what we're seeing is fewer watches, but at a higher price point. Now, obviously, that's the nature of things. But is it indicative of a really dangerous climate for the watchmaking industry to have found itself in, to have created for itself? Because what that means is we have fewer customers. Yes, they may have been willing to spend that money in the last 3 years, but now are they going to be, and have we in the process as an industry turned off people in general from buying watches because of the practices that we've been following?
Oh man, that last one's a good point, because you know, one of the reasons I think Jean-Claude Beauvais is so legendary is because you could make a case like he saved the watch industry as we know it. The watch industry is how it is today because of his insight that a watch does not have to be a tool. It can be an object of luxury and an object of desire. And companies have run with that. And as tends to happen, so as I said, the enshittification of everything, that's just the snowball effect of like late stage capitalism. And in the same kind of way, not, it hasn't obviously taken the same trajectory, but in the same kind of way, that trend that you described, Rob, is now reaching its most like its sharpest point, if I could say that. So as I said, I think in the first article of the series, the only way that the industry grows is to raise price, to sell more watches to people who already own them, or to grow the pie, and then of course sell more watches to those new entrants to the hobby. But people, I think, are leaving the hobby, because of, you know, it's different from the pandemic. They've got more time to they've got more time to focus on other things. And so I don't know that it wouldn't be a bad idea, I don't think, to evaluate, you know, what are we selling? Because an Omega watch it's a luxury product. It is a well done, and so is a Rolex, by the way. I mean, these are luxury watches. But again, going back to this message of identifying your target audience and adapting the marketing to them. If in fact the target audience now are people who are coming into the hobby, like why not readapt the marketing to this is an object of desire, but it can also be a very practical one. And so really going full circle from what Jean-Claude Beauvais started, what, 40, 50 years ago now almost.
Deep. We went deep, but I still didn't hear examples. So I'm going to help you guys. Why is Nomos perceived as great value for money?
Okay, good one. Yeah, we probably should have started with that. I reckon Nomos has pulled off something pretty special throughout its existence. There are very few brands that really manage to capitalize on moments as effectively as a brand like Nomos has done. Rolex has done it throughout its history. It's why Rolex is where it is. You know, we see a lot of people looking at Rolex and trying to emulate a success, but it's impossible. It was just there at the right time. It did the right things. It was a leader in many ways. Now, Nomos has done something else. It was founded at a very difficult time for Germany. Of course, the reunification was not as smooth domestically as perhaps it looked internationally. And it was a beacon of hope in a way, a beacon of fun, a shining light in Glaceter as Glaceter started to rebuild itself after the GDR period. And it shifted, really, because of the force of will of Roland Schwertner, the founder and still head honcho of the brand. It was originally a design brand that bought in its movements from Switzerland, and it would advertise in very cutesy ways, as far as we would see it now in newspapers. And the start of the company was extremely humble. They had like a little office above a, I think it was a kebab shop or a pizza shop somewhere in Dusseldorf, where most of the operations would take place before they were actually able to relocate to Glasgow full time. And they would get calls on a single telephone and they would fulfill orders. So it was, I guess, for its era, perhaps one of the first micro brands in a cute way. I've never said that before, but it certainly had that vibe. And there was this vision to really honor the legacy of Glaceter and to bring manufacturing back to it in an affordable way. The cost of developing the DEW3001 3.2mm thick automatic that launched in 2015 was stratospheric. And had it not been for Nomos's approachable and accessible communication style, I don't think they'd ever have had the money necessary to go ahead with that project. They transitioned to that. Their prices did leap up, and people forget this now, I think, because the prices have remained relatively static for a brand of such reputation and deep roots in the industry these days over the pandemic period. Nomos never tried to leverage that success in the way that other brands have. Yes, they've done special editions. Yes, they've sold out rapidly, but they've always done so in a bit more of a responsible fashion, in my opinion. Maybe I'm biased, I don't know, but I certainly advocate the way they've gone about it. I think that they've innovated in a watchmaking sense, which is rare for a product that costs, you know, even less than 5,000 for something with a DEW6101, which is the updated version of the 3001 with a peripheral date that has a safety mechanism fitted to it so that you can't damage the movement if you set the date between 10 and 2 and you can move the date forwards and backwards. These are like user-friendly things. Now, to David's point, perhaps Nomos is the best example of actually knowing their customer. The customer is not the same customer as it was 20 years ago, and that's a price point thing. But I think because Nomos had established itself so well as a watchmaker's an enthusiast brand, shall we say, that they were able to pivot and refocus on a new market and provide that market with a product that they were sorely lacking. And there is better watchmaking in a Nomos for 5K than there is in a Rolex for 10. Now, the movement is not as robust. Obviously, it's much thinner. It can't be as robust. And that's fine, because what you get at the end of the day is a very wearable watch that can be worn in different situations from a Submariner or an Explorer too. But I would say, going back to that material quality aspect that I always point to, that's a great example of something that actually offers a lot for your money. It's great styling. Nearly every watch in the collection is an absolute beaut. Not a fan of all of them, but I certainly love the ones that I love. And now the movements are on a par with the aesthetics. And although that did change the brand's price point, it didn't absolutely alienate it. And I think that is a very, very good example, Alan. A brilliant one. I don't know why it wasn't the first out of my mouth, but yeah. I would say, therefore, my answer to your question originally is Nomos offers a great value product. Omega now is starting to lose its grip on what it once had, in my opinion, an iron-fisted grip on.
Thank you for that. I think we should wrap it up, but let's end it with a little tip. What brand or newcomer or model should our listeners keep an eye on that gives them great value besides all of those that we already mentioned up until now?
Oh, man. I got to think about it. Rob, do you have an answer? Because that's a fantastic question. I just have to think about it for a second.
Well, again, my answers are going to be slightly biased, so I'll get the most biased one out of the way first. I'd say Straum, because I know what goes into the creation of those dials, and it's a really pure concept, and it's something that people can get behind. Seeing the watches really tested in an environment for which they're designed, I think that's a great brand. They're constantly trying to work on refining every aspect of the watch, its wearing experience, what you get for your money. It's not the cheapest small independent brand out there, but at 2,000 euros, including taxes, it's, I think, an absolute humdinger. And then the other one is Anodyne. Because if we're talking about luxury, if we're talking about scarcity by nature, then Anodyne, in the same way as Arkanaut, it can't be anything but that by definition. It's incredible. The prices are way too low. Lewis, the founder, regrets it daily that he didn't try and milk it for all it was worth because he was too good-hearted and wanted to create a product that was affordable but extremely interesting from an artisanal perspective. And he succeeded. He succeeded in that. And I think if Anodyne are going to improve the horological offering as well and get really creative with the case designs, maybe bring some bracelets into the fray, then we're going to see a brand that will step up in price point just like Nomos, but with very good reasons, and be this generation's Nomos. And I'd say watch this space, because they're a brand that will give you a lot for your money.
As you were talking, Rob, the answer came to me. It's like so obvious as far as what I've said before. So I'm going to stay on brand and say that if you're looking for phenomenal value, Hermes, Montblanc, Ralph Lauren, all these quote fashion watches we've talked about ad nauseum before. I think you get fantastic design, excellent quality, and you get a proper legitimate watch for a fraction of what it would cost MSRP and a fraction of what an equivalent watch from an established brand would cost. So check those out, and I think you'll be in for some nice prizes.
That is actually an episode we need to record separately, because Hermes, we can fill an whole hour about discussing that, but let me not do that. I asked the question, and then I'm like, shoot, why am I asking these damn difficult questions? Because now I need to answer myself. But I guess, besides the brands that we already discussed, and good ones, Rob and David, some of yours, David, I guess I would mention maybe Nevada Gretchen. They bring you a lot of bang for your buck if you like the retro-inspired models, because you rightfully said so, Rob. It depends on what you're looking for and in what style, design, what functions, and what do you demand of a watch, and in what price bracket. So those are my two cents.
Very good. Well, this turned out to be an extremely fluid episode, barely any breaks or pauses for thought in it at all. And I can see why, because it's a fascinating topic, David. You've unlocked it again for us with your article. So thank you for writing that. And I can't wait for the next one of these shows where we do the article and the analysis immediately afterwards. I think it's a very satisfying format. If you feel the same, please let us know. If you feel differently, even more importantly, let us know. You can contact us via Instagram. David can be found at DAVAUCHER. I'm there at ROBNUDDS. And Alon, of course, is there at ALONBENJOSEPH. You can email Alon or me at either Rob or Alon at therealtime.show, or contact us via the contact form on the website, www.therealtime.show. But keep an eye on that website, because it's going to be changing very, very soon. And we can't wait to reveal exactly what we've been working on for the past few months. I know we've been promising it for a while, but as it turns out, web development is really tricky. Anyway, until next time, please stay safe and keep on ticking.